KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Trump administration is pushing the boundaries of federal law as it moves to increase deportations. We will catch you up on a week that involves standoffs with federal judges and concerns the due process was violated. For Saturday, March 22nd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we will remember Kitty Dukakis, who died at age 88, and we will hit the ice. Washington Capitals superstar Alex Ovechkin is inching closer to becoming the NHL's all-time leading goal scorer.
It's going to be a memorable experience, and I hope she looks back on everything associated with Ovechkin and realizing that she was around to see one of the greatest of all time.
Plus maple syrup in Maine and a visit to NPR's Tiny Desk, where we will talk to classical pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet.
Everybody played Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff. When you think of Russian composer and poor Kachaturin, is kind of a little bit forgotten.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. In a new move to increase deportations, the Trump administration is canceling a program that allowed over 500,000 people to be in the U.S. legally. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has more.
The Department of Homeland Security said that it will revoke what was considered a parole program for 500,000 people who are Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. This means that people who are currently eligible to work, go to school, and be in the U.S. are set up for a potential deportation in about a month. While President Trump campaigned on increasing deportations, particularly of those without legal status, he has also taken steps to remove authorization for those already in the U.S. The administration has also paused processing asylum and visa applications for those who entered under this program. The move to revoke parole programs has already been challenged in federal court. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
Lebanese officials tell NPR that seven people have been killed in a barrage of Israeli airstrikes Saturday on Lebanon. Lebanese state media say more than a dozen towns and villages were hit, including a city on the Mediterranean coast. NPR's Jawad Rizkala reports from nearby Damascus.
One mayor in Lebanon South tells NPR an Israeli drone hit his village and that residents are panicking. People are evacuating other villages. Lebanon's health ministry says the dead include at least one child. The Israeli military said it was targeting Hezbollah after rockets were fired earlier at Israel. No one was injured there. Hezbollah denied firing those and says it's committed to a ceasefire that began in November. The Lebanese army published photos of wooden rocket launchers it says it found and dismantled. It's not the type of weapon Hezbollah is known to have used. These are the deadliest attacks since last year's ceasefire. UN peacekeepers say they've since tallied more than 680 attacks violating that truce, the vast majority of them by Israel. Jawad Rizkallah, NPR News, Damascus.
After an extensive hospitalization, the Vatican says Pope Francis will be released tomorrow. His doctors say he will need months of additional rest to be able to recover completely. NPR's Emma Bowman has details.
The 88-year-old pontiff has spent over 5 weeks at Rome's Gemelli Hospital. He was admitted with a case of bronchitis that doctors said had evolved into pneumonia in both of his lungs. Sergio Alfieri, the hospital's head of surgery, told journalists on Saturday that the Pope is in stable condition and that he will continue to receive medical care while at the Vatican.
Today we are happy to say that tomorrow he will be at home.
The Vatican says Francis will give his blessing shortly after noon on Sunday to a crowd outside the hospital, his first public appearance since being hospitalized. Emma Bowman, NPR News.
This is NPR. At London's Heathrow Airport, British Airways says it was able to deliver 90% of its Saturday schedule after an electrical substation fire shut down flights for almost a full day. In general, airlines operating in the major hubs say they expect disruptions to last for days. After more than 16,000 structures were damaged or destroyed in the Los Angeles wildfires, one organization is taking on a less traditional form of disaster relief, fireproofing history. Andrea Dominic of member station KCRW has the story.
On a recent Sunday afternoon at the Hammer Museum in L.A., two dozen volunteers gathered over laptops and cups of coffee for a Wikipedia edit-a-thon. They're writing new entries about the landmarks and community hubs lost in the wildfires. adding citations, updating information, and uploading photos.
We have the potential ourselves to preserve what we lost and make sure that what was destroyed in the fires isn't forgotten.
That's Emery D'Alessio, a facilitator with WikiLA who's helping train newcomers. So far, more than 40 articles have been created or updated at edit-a-thons like this one, and they're already resonating. D'Alessio says those articles have racked up more than 200,000 views since their edits. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Dominic in Los Angeles.
President Trump is in Pennsylvania this evening, where he is attending the NCAA Wrestling Championships. The event at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia was expected to be a big night for Penn State's wrestling team. The president says he supports all the college wrestling teams. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. This past week, President Trump's administration took unprecedented actions in its effort to ramp up deportations. It sent more than 100 Venezuelan immigrants to a third country, El Salvador, where they were imprisoned, all of this without due process. And then the administration seemingly ignored a federal judge's order to stop those deportations, even if that meant turning the planes around mid-flight. This has all opened back up the major question of whether the Trump White House will follow the law and defer to courts. All of this, of course, on an issue that Trump campaigned on more than anything else. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has been tracking all of this and joins us now. Hey, Jimena.
Hey, Scott.
Look, Trump made so many promises on this front on the campaign trail. How is he seeing those through?
He really focused on having a plan for a, quote, mass deportation effort. In his first 2 months in office, he has taken steps to see this through. Immigration and Customs Enforcement regional offices have daily arrest quotas to meet. Detention centers are maxed out, and this is according to DHS themselves. On the trail, he also promised to use things like the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to be able to deport people quickly. We saw this come through last weekend when he invoked the act and, as you mentioned, sent over 130 Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador.
And this act, the Alien Enemies Act, has become really important lately. Remind us what it is, why Trump says he's using it.
It's a wartime power, only used three other times. It allows the government to detain and deport those it suspects of being part of an enemy nation. And he's targeting those accused by the administration of being Tren de Aragua gang members. But recent legal filings from the government also acknowledge that many did not have criminal records in the U.S.
And this was the focus of those court hearings and rulings that got a lot of attention this past week and really raised these serious questions that the administration is ignoring the federal courts. What comes next on that front?
Well, the government has until Tuesday to decide if it's invoking a special power that would allow them to not give the judge information on deportation flights used under the act. The judge wants this information to know if his orders to turn those planes around were ignored.
Okay, so that's the stuff that got the most attention over the past week. What else is Trump trying to do to reach this big goal when it comes to these mass deportations he's promised?
We're also seeing a push to remove protections from those who were given permission to be in the United States by the Biden administration. Most recently, the Department of Homeland Security said that it will revoke what's considered a parole program for 500,000 people who are Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. This means that people who are currently eligible to work, go to school, and be in the U.S. are set up for potential deportations in about a month.
So, Jimena, you were covering all of the stuff that Trump was promising as he ran for president. You're covering all the stuff that Trump is doing now that he is president. Have those goals changed at all?
You know, so much of the president's rhetoric on the campaign trail focused on tackling crime in relation to immigration generally. And Trump officials have changed their messaging a bit on this front. Ahead of inauguration, the message was really focused on going after people who had committed violent crimes in the U.S. And since they have pulled back to also say that they will arrest anyone without legal status. Earlier this month, immigration officers told reporters that they had made just over 32,000 arrests so far. But of those, more than half did not have criminal records in the U.S. There have been high-profile arrests of people being detained who are lawful permanent residents and on student visas, and also reports of people who are married to U.S. citizens without criminal records having encounters with immigration officials. Mm-hmm. And even U.S. citizens have been questioned and arrested by immigration officials. But immigration advocates warned that the administration could be skirting due process throughout all this. Even in immigration court, you have the right to argue your case to withhold or even cancel a final deportation order, and some people might be eligible for asylum or simply proving that they're not a member of a gang, according to immigrant rights groups.
What's been happening at the Department of Homeland Security as it tries to do all of these things at once?
Several members of law enforcement across other agencies like the Justice Department or Treasury have been tapped in to do immigration law enforcement work. And they're also taking part in a broader effort to reduce the size of the department by cutting people and positions they say are in the way of enforcement. Yesterday, staff at DHS, particularly within watchdog agencies that do oversight on immigration detention and benefits processes, were laid off.
Okay, so what other challenges do they still face then?
Well, Border Czar Tom Homan has said that they need more money, which can only come from Congress, to sustainably scale up. There just aren't enough people or space and not enough resources to do the big operation that Trump wants, even though we have seen these efforts scale up. Plus, the administration is fighting several lawsuits, like those from immigrants rights groups pushing back against the use of the Alien Enemies Act and other arrests.
That is NPR's Jimena Bustillo covering all of this for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kitty Dukakis, the former First Lady of Massachusetts and an outspoken advocate for people with mental illness and addiction, has died. She was 88 years old. She spoke publicly about living with addiction and depression as far back as 1987 when her husband, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, launched a campaign for president. From member station WBUR, Lisa Mullins reports that Kitty Dukakis created a legacy both despite her mental health problems and because of them.
Catherine Kitty Dukakis wasn't born into politics. Her father was a beloved conductor of the Boston Pops. She studied modern dance. Kitty was thrust into the political spotlight when her husband ran for president. That's when she revealed she had been addicted to diet pills for years. It started in college. Michael Dukakis lost the election in 1988 to George H.W. Bush, and Kitty spiraled down into depression and drinking. And again, she went public.
I speak from experience. As all of you know, I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic.
Here's Dukakis at the Women's National Democratic Club in 1990.
Alcohol and drug addiction strike women and men, and yet our society still attaches a special stigma to the female alcoholic or drug addict.
Kitty Dukakis released a bracingly candid memoir. She wrote about the times she was on a desperate search for alcohol. She settled instead for rubbing alcohol, mouthwash, and even nail polish remover. Dukakis knew her voice could make a difference on a range of issues. Her friend Anne Hawley is a Massachusetts arts leader who worked on cultural causes with Kitty Dukakis.
Kitty instinctively understood the power that was afforded her by her position as the First Lady of Massachusetts, and she really knew how to use it, and she did use it for other people's benefit, not for herself.
Among those who benefited, people without homes. Kitty Dukakis co-chaired the governor's advisory committee on the homeless. She got to know people in shelters, and with the help of her activism, the number of state-funded homeless shelters in Massachusetts increased dramatically. She was also passionate about her Jewish heritage and sat on a presidential Holocaust commission. And she embraced the plight of refugees. She worked to bring many of them to the U.S.
Without her, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here today.
That's Pike Hoot, who's from Cambodia. He lost most of his family to the regime of dictator Pol Pot. His one surviving sister was taken in by a couple from Massachusetts. She wrote a letter to ask First Lady Dukakis to rescue her brother from the border camp where he was living as a teenager. Hoot remembers the day this important woman arrived, escorted by armed guards.
She kneeled down and talked to me at the level of my sight, you know. She's very calm and very, brave. She grabbed my hands tight. She never let go, you know, when she saw me.
1 month later, Kitty Dukakis brought Hoot to live in Massachusetts. Today he works as a physician assistant. Kitty Dukakis kept changing lives even as she wrestled with crippling depression. Finally, in 2001, she found a treatment that changed her life, electroconvulsive therapy. ECT was controversial. It conjured up horrifying and misleading scenes from the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Journalist Larry Tye wrote a book with Dukakis about the treatment. He says many people who read the book emailed stories of their own mental health struggles.
I'd get the emails. I would be floored by them. I would forward them to her, and she would insist on getting in touch with everybody who had emailed to try to help them.
Kitty Dukakis became such a champion for ECT, she even let CBS's 60 Minutes record one of her sessions.
You're okay with the treatment we filmed being broadcast?
Yeah, I am. I'm convinced that if I can be that public, that it will help others.
Reporter Anderson Cooper described the scene.
Dukakis was sedated, and electricity was administered to her brain for a few seconds.
Kitty's son, John Dukakis, says the family never tried to dissuade her from being so public.
Tucking my mother out of most anything was often a fool's errand. And, you know, ECT, my parents feel very strongly about, saved my mother's life. So the idea of kind of sharing that message more broadly, there was never any question about it.
Friends of Kitty Dukakis universally recall that conviction and courage and her empathy. One friend said Kitty turned her demons into possibilities for others. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Mullins.
NPR reporting team went to Greenland recently, and they were there to get a firsthand look at how climate change is altering life for citizens who live in some pretty remote areas.
These are people who have lived in Greenland their whole lives, and they're pointing to these tangible examples every day of how climate has affected them.
My co-host Juana Summers tells us about her recent reporting trip to Greenland, and yes, it does include sled dogs. That conversation tomorrow on All Things Considered from NPR News. You can listen on the radio, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Israel says it has fired on multiple Hezbollah targets in Lebanon in response to rockets fired on Israel from Lebanon. Lebanese officials say there have been deaths and injuries. Hezbollah denied firing the rockets. Officials in Ukraine say a Russian drone attack on the city of Zaporizhia has left several people dead and wounded despite a recent limited ceasefire. After a policy standoff, the Venezuelan government has agreed to accept repatriation flights from the U.S. carrying its deported nationals. Flights are expected to resume tomorrow. I'm Luis Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. We are standing here in the entranceway to Capital One Arena in downtown Washington, D.C. Hockey fans are streaming through the gates because the Capitals are about to play the Philadelphia Flyers, and everyone is focused on the fact that Alex Ovechkin, the Capitals captain, is on the precipice of breaking the NHL's all-time goal-scoring record. At the beginning of the night, Ovechkin is 8 goals shy of setting the record. In the arena's main hallway, there's a throne almost, made up of hundreds of rubber black hockey pucks meant to show the goals that he scored. Fans are taking pictures sitting in it.
We're with NPR. We're doing a story on Ovechkin, just talking to his fans. Can we talk to you for a second?
Matt Walsh and his daughter Sawyer drove out from Virginia to be a part of the countdown to hockey history.
It's going to be a memorable experience, and I hope she looks back on everything associated with Ovechkin and realizing that she was around to see one of the greatest of all time play in our hometown. And seeing that and get her to experience that with me and share that love is nothing more than you could ever dream.
What do you like about Alex Ovechkin?
I love how he has scored so many goals and is almost the world champion.
I love how many people in the store are shopping for Alex Ovechkin jerseys as they wear Alex Ovechkin jerseys. But Samuel Corkadel is decked out in Flyers gear.
You're a Flyers fan. Are you still cheering for Ovechkin to get the record?
Absolutely.
And since you're not a homer, can I ask, what do you think makes Ovechkin so special?
His endurance. You know, a lot of players don't really last the way he does. He plays a physical kind of game, swings the body around, hasn't had any real serious injuries. You know, he comes back every year like a little better than they did before if it's training. Yeah, he definitely deserves to be where he is.
You knew that this player was explosive. You knew that he was special, but you figured that there would be some time where he would shrink from the pressure. He never did.
That's longtime Washington Capitals play-by-play man Joe Beninati.
A remarkable nonprofit organization.
We go.
He is a broadcaster through and through, to the point where, as we talk in the press box, he pauses the interview to yell across the arena to the PA system operator in order to get us a quieter scene.
Popcorn Stealer!
You don't need to do 10 different sound checks of things you've tested 100 times. I'm just teasing you.
Those efforts don't work, and we have to relocate to a back hallway to keep talking. Beninati called Ovechkin's first goal back in October 2005. Ovechkin's very first game in a decades-long career with the Capitals.
Ovechkin fires, he scores! Alexander Ovechkin, welcome on board!
It was clear then that Ovechkin would be special, but no one thought he or anyone could approach the all-time goal record held by Wayne Gretzky, who had retired 6 years earlier.
Every time you open a history book, a hockey encyclopedia, you see Wayne Gretzky's numbers, and they are daunting. And you would figure untouchable, unapproachable, unassailable, none of those.
Ovechkin kept scoring, often notching 50 goals or more a season. It only took him just a decade to hit the milestone of 500 goals, which is a surefire ticket to the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Backdoor look, Ovechkin rips.
Nash. Welcome to the club, number 500 for the Great Eights.
When Alex clicked for 500 so fast and gave every impression that he truly was this Russian machine that didn't break, he was there so often that his consistency, I'm not a math major, but if you did the math, you started to figure if he played long enough, if he had the drive, the motivation, if his talents never waned, that he could approach that number.
Ovechkin has been durable. He's kept playing through the wear and tear that comes with professional sports. He's about to hit age 40, ancient in NHL hockey. The record is getting closer, and soon Gretzky himself will be coming to every Capitals game so he can congratulate Ovechkin in person. And Beninati knows that when the record-breaking goal happens, his voice will be tied to the moment.
We all want to have some touch on it. I can't tell you that I'm going to sit there and go, well, I know exactly what I'm going to say. Yeah. Because it's a fluid sport. I pray that it's a beautiful Alex Ovechkin, clear-cut, no-doubt goal. Ones that we've seen hundreds of times over, but you never know what it might be.
The game begins and the first place Capitals start strong. Ovechkin delivers a big body check on his first shift. And midway through the first period, he gets the puck right in front of a wide open Flyers goal, fires it in. One more for Ovechkin, moving it from 887 to 888. Ovechkin one closer to that all-time record, 7 goals to go. The Flyers make it close at the end of the game, but Washington holds on for a win. Afterwards, Ovechkin sits in the corner of the locker room, surrounded by reporters, asking him about his chase.
And that's why the beginning of the year and the middle of the year, it's very important to collecting the points and
Capitals head coach Spencer Carberry says the chase is clearly affecting the team, even as it looks to lock up a top playoff spot.
They're pulling for him. I think it energizes them to play at a higher level, to be honest with you, and raise their game. And when they're playing with them, and as a coach, I feel like this chase and the energy around it, it hasn't been a distraction or a hindrance to our group. It's been a massive benefit.
Ovechkin has about a dozen regular season games left this year. As he tries to break the record, he and the Capitals are also trying to set themselves up for a playoff run and an opportunity to bolster his legacy even more by winning a second Stanley Cup. The arrest of the mayor of Istanbul, a prominent rival of the president of Turkey, has set off pro-democracy protests across that country, despite a temporary ban on gatherings.
Son vermeye geliyoruz. Son vermeye geliyoruz.
At least 340 people were detained overnight. As reporter Duri Buscarin reports, Turkey's main opposition party says it still plans to hold a vote nominating the imprisoned mayor as its presidential candidate.
On Friday night, thousands of people streamed into the park across the street from the offices of imprisoned Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Samet is a 24-year-old grad student.
The right of people to choose and be elected and the rule of law has been dealt a blow, and it wasn't the first, and it won't be the last.
Samet and others in this report asked that their full names not be used because Turkish law prohibits certain criticisms of the government and arrests against protesters are still ongoing. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been in power for 22 years, presiding over a flailing economy and consolidating most branches of government under his oversight. İmamoğlu emerged in 2019 as a charismatic candidate who seemed to have the popularity to oust Erdogan in a presidential election. To formally nominate him as a presidential candidate, his party made the unusual step of holding a primary, scheduled for Sunday. Sevgi, a retired nurse, says İmamoğlu's arrest felt like a coup.
İmamoğlu en güçlü rakibi Recep Tayyip Erdoğan. Onu görevden alarak, hapse koyarak aslında önündeki engelleri kaldırmış oluyor.
İmamoğlu is Erdoğan's strongest opponent, Sevgi says. By removing him, by putting him in jail, he's removing the obstacles in his way. Sevgi still intends to vote for İmamoğlu on Sunday. But as groups of students and young people stream in to join the protest, she nods with the concern of a supportive but worried parent.
Yani patlama noktası gibi oldu galiba. Bakalım, göreceğiz.
It's like an explosion point, she says. Turkish prosecutors accuse İmamoğlu of leading an elaborate conspiracy of bribery, embezzlement, and fraud, as well as ties to terrorism. His supporters, like this psychology professor who did not share her name out of fear of losing her job, say the charges are ludicrous.
When they want to accuse somebody, they can turn normal politics into terrorism charges. It's very strategic. They just use law as a tool to go after who they want to go after.
But these charges could also bar İmamoğlu from holding office. Just before his arrest, his university also revoked his college degree, another move widely seen as political.
I'm sure people will be on the streets till they get the politicians to understand that you can't just suppress forever.
Turkey's presidential communications office has denied that İmamoğlu's arrest is political, insisting that the country is governed by the rule of law. But it has struggled to contain the protests erupting across the country.
It's a make or break point for Turkish democracy.
Yusuf Can, a Turkish politics analyst at the Washington-based Wilson Center, says this is part of Erdogan's strategy to stay in power indefinitely. The head of İmamoğlu's party has been spending the night at Istanbul's city offices, concerned that Erdogan will appoint a loyalist trustee to oversee the city.
People want a future. People want to be able to determine who gets to rule them.
The arrest of İmamoğlu has created a groundswell of support for his opposition party, John says, even among people who consider themselves apolitical. On Sunday, opposition party members will still go to the ballot box to vote for İmamoğlu in the party's first presidential primary in recent memory.
It's been done. People do it, but it's not that often. I'm looking forward to the turnout, honestly. I'm quite curious.
Turkey's next presidential election is scheduled for 2028, but it's widely believed that Erdogan will call for early elections, a move that would allow him to bypass term limits. For NPR News, I'm Derya Buskarin, Istanbul.
Here's a deep and existential question. Could the universe eventually end by collapsing on itself? That theory may now be a little more possible, according to new findings from a group of astrophysics researchers, and the reason, they say, involves dark energy. NPR's Chandelise Duster reports.
Scientists who worked on the project say when the universe formed, dark energy, the mysterious force behind its rapid expansion, was very strong. That noise is a simulation by University of Washington physics professor emeritus John Kramer of what the universe may have sounded like as it expanded after the Big Bang. The universe is still expanding and actually speeding up in that expansion. Now, research by the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument Group, also known as DESI, says that dark energy is changing. Mustafa Ishak, co-chair of the group and an astrophysics professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, says dark energy is weakening and could continue to do so. And this could allow matter to get stronger, which then could be the force that causes the universe to stop expanding and retract.
We thought before that the universe will keep just expanding and expanding faster and faster and faster and faster. Almost it becomes empty. It is back to the table. The universe now also has the possibility that it will stop and recollapse.
This data makes that end of universe scenario more likely than it has seemed in decades. But there are other theories about the universe's fate. The dominant one is that if dark energy continues to push the accelerating expansion of the universe forever, galaxies will move away from each other and stars will fade. If this happens, the universe will become dark, cold, and empty. Another scenario that's far less likely is that the universe continues to expand so rapidly that it tears itself apart. Ultimately, researchers have no idea how the universe will end. But when it does, Ishak says it will happen very far in the future.
Billions and billions and billions of years. So it's not something that happens overnight.
He and other scientists also say there is no current evidence that the universe has stopped expanding. Back in 2024, DESE released data that also found signs that dark energy is evolving. Next up, the group plans to analyze 5 years' worth of data from its surveys of the universe. Ishak says he hopes that the data will not only confirm their findings about dark energy, but help them get a better understanding of the mysterious force. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Whether it is on pancakes, waffles, bacon, or even, I don't know about this, but some people do it, your morning coffee, maple syrup has a completely distinctive flavor. And every year at this time, maple farmers in Maine throw open the doors to their sugar houses to show the public how it's done. Maine Public Radio's Molly N. King reports for one family of eighth-generation maple producers, this year has been a long time coming.
It's a gray, rainy March day outside, but inside the Green family sugar shack, it's nice and warm. Three generations of Greens are gathered in their sugar house, prepping for one of their biggest events of the year. So far, they've boiled down 187 gallons of maple syrup, Zoe Green tells me, and it's only 10 in the morning.
It's fun. It's kind of one of those things where you're amped up, ready to go.
The wood stove is blazing, and above us, the ceiling is completely obscured by sweet-smelling steam, billowing from the bubbling tanks of sap that are slowly but surely boiling down into syrup. Alan Green is a sixth-generation maple producer. To say he's got it down to a science would be an understatement. To hear him talk, he may as well be a sommelier.
Every batch that comes off that evaporator is different. Every batch has a different nuance to it. It has a different flavor.
Soon, this syrup will be bottled and ready for the thousands of people who descend on sugar houses for the fourth weekend of March for Maple Syrup Sunday, the height of what is known as sugar season here in Maine.
We want it to be fresh, so we make it the night before, and by noon tomorrow, it'll be gone.
But it won't just be in liquid form. Valerie Green has been hard at work whipping up maple cookies, maple whoopie pies, a local Maine dessert, and even spicy maple salsa. Mainers have been celebrating Maple Syrup Sunday for 42 years, and Alan Green's father, Ted, was one of the founders. As the years have gone on, each maple farm gives it their own spin, from live fiddle music to maple cotton candy to tree tapping demos. And of course, pancake breakfasts. I get a little preview of what visitors in this sugar shack will be tasting. A tiny cup of syrup straight from the hot stove.
Oh my God. What? That's insanely good.
It has a flavor all its own. Buttery, rich, with notes of vanilla. When I was a kid, we drizzled the hot syrup over a fresh cup of snow straight from outside. These days, Mainers carry on the tradition over ice cream. For the Green family, this year is the culmination of years of work. They opened their new sugar shack just in time for the season. It's about four times as big as the old one. Brothers Jason and Alan Green say their dad poured the concrete foundation for this building over 25 years ago, but he never got to finish it.
It seems like it makes you feel a little emotional.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that because of your dad?
Oh, definitely. This building was his dream.
When his dad passed away several years ago, Alan Green carried on that dream, finally finishing the new sugar house. The wooden cart his dad used to haul wood in is still in use, right next to the wood stove. Green says it was his father's vision to have a warm, insulated place to work during winter weather.
Oh, it was miserable. I mean, it was nights where we were huddled against the evaporator to stay warm. The wind was howling. We don't have to deal with that now.
Making syrup for a living is no joke. It takes roughly 40 gallons of sap from a maple tree to make 1 gallon of syrup. After all the hard work, Maine Maple Sunday is a celebration.
Sugar season is a rite of spring. It always has been. You know, the old timers would come up to my father and say, "I see you tapped." And they'd see the buckets on the trees. And it was like a relief for them that I made it till spring. I survived another winter.
For NPR News, I'm Molly Enking, reporting from Sebago, Maine.
This is NPR News.
In Bob the Drag Queen's new novel, Harriet Tubman comes back to life and wants to use hip-hop to promote her cause.
If you're a theater nerd, if you're a black queer, if you're a history buff,
If you like hip-hop music, if you like absurd concepts, this book could be for you.
Our conversation, plus the latest political developments, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. The Trump administration is canceling a program that gave limited approval for thousands to be in the U.S. legally, revoking what was considered a parole program for 500,000 people who are Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. London's Heathrow Airport says it's open and operational after an electrical substation fire shut down flights for almost a full day. Airlines operating in the major hub say they expect disruptions to last for days. After spending 38 days in a hospital battling double pneumonia, the Vatican says that Pope Francis will be sent home tomorrow. The Vatican says just before that, the Pope will bless the faithful from his 10th floor suite at Rome's Gemelli Hospital. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Few topics are more complex and often upsetting than the cost of health care in the United States. Well, reporter Dan Weissman tackles the topic head-on in his podcast, An Arm and a Leg. One recent episode, which Dan reported in February, looks at how the Trump administration's huge sudden cuts to the government are playing out in the real world. That's because in recent years, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has taken major steps to help people drowning in medical debt until this February, when the administration essentially shut the agency down.
Lara Cesarelli works for American Financial Solutions. That's a nonprofit credit counseling agency. So Lara spends her days talking with people who have bills they can't pay, debt collectors chasing them, including for medical bills. For years, whenever Lara's talked to a client and it sounds like a debt collector is violating their rights, which happens a lot, she has referred the client to the CFPB, and it has worked.
It makes a difference feeling like you've got a powerhouse at your back.
But that Sunday night, February 9th, news broke that an official President Donald Trump had put in charge of the CFPB was basically shutting the agency down, effective immediately. Agency staff had gotten a memo telling them to stop doing their jobs.
I felt my stomach sink through the floor.
I talked with Lara just over a week after that Sunday night, and we're going to hear how she managed that first week and how she started shifting what she tells clients, like what other resources she's still referring them to. But first, we should talk about why the CFPB has been such a big deal, especially for people with medical debts.
My name is Chi-Chi Wu. I'm a senior attorney at the National Consumer Law Center.
Chi-Chi Wu says it didn't take long for medical debts to land in the agency's crosshairs.
In 2014, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did a study that found if you look at the debt collection items on credit reports.
In other words, if you ask, when people get put in collections, what are the bills actually for?
Over half of them are for medical debt. Half. It was a huge number.
Which added up to a ton of people having lousy credit scores, not because they'd taken a cruise they couldn't pay for, but because they'd gotten sick.
It was a huge problem. People would try to be buying a house or a car, trying to get a credit card, and they'd have to pay more or even get turned down.
And now that huge problem was on the record, thanks to the CFPB. So the next year, a bunch of state attorneys general reached a voluntary agreement with the big three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. The big three agreed that now they'd wait 180 days, 6 months, before putting a medical debt on somebody's credit report.
So the idea was the consumer would have 6 months to straighten out insurance, figure out what they actually owed, maybe dispute it if they didn't think they owed it.
In 2020, the CFPB issued a new rule. It stopped a practice called parking that bill collectors had been using, especially for small medical debts.
They wouldn't send a single letter. They wouldn't make a single phone call. All they would do is report that debt to the credit bureaus and wait. Would just wait until the consumer had to use their credit score for something, you know, refinance their mortgage, buy a car, get a new credit card.
Rent an apartment, apply for a job.
All of those. And then their credit would get pulled, this medical debt would show up, and they'd be left scrambling because they would have to clear that debt from their credit report before they could get that mortgage or car loan or job or apartment.
So people paid up. They didn't have a choice.
And the reason debt collectors do that is because it's cheap. It's cheap to do credit reporting. It's expensive to send a letter.
Chi-Chi Wu says the CFPB started working on a rule banning parking during the second Obama administration and finalized the rule in 2020 under Donald Trump. It takes a while. When Joe Biden became president, he appointed a CFPB director who put extra focus on medical debts. The credit bureaus got the idea they might be subject to some new rules on the topic and volunteered to make some changes of their own. In May 2022, they announced instead of waiting just 6 months to put medical bills on credit reports, they were going to wait a full year.
And then they agreed not to report medical debts under $500.
When I talked with Laura Cesarelli, she told me she could see the CFPB's impact in her day-to-day work.
I used to have at least one conversation about medical debt a day, usually more. And that's not the case. You know, I'm having a couple of conversations per week, maybe, about medical debt. So we've seen the impact.
And she could see more on the horizon. In January, before the inauguration, the CFPB actually issued new rules about medical debt. Under the new rules, all medical debts would come off of credit reports. And lenders could not look at medical debts when making lending decisions. So the CFPB had planned to start enforcing those rules in March. Now, the whole agency was shutting down. Laura says she's had to revise what she's used to telling clients.
You can say, you know, the CFPB is incredibly solid. They will support you. And I can't say that anymore.
So she's telling people, hey, it's worth calling the CFPB just in case somebody picks up. But meanwhile, here's some other places to call.
I had a client who has been threatened by a debt collector, and that debt that they're collecting on is actually outside of the statute of limitations. It's not collectible anymore, but they're being harassed, basically calling them at all hours of the day and night and advising them that, you know, they're still subject to legal action, none of which is true.
Which means, Laura tells me, that collector is breaking a law called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Normally, I would have sent that client in the direction of the CFPB.
Normally, you file a complaint with the CFPB, the company responds to you within 15 days, according to the agency's website. Laura says companies pay attention because the CFPB has a big stick. In 2023, the agency shut down one medical debt collection company for violating this very law. That version of normal is gone for now. But Laura happens to know the Federal Trade Commission, which is still up and running, also has authority to enforce that law. Other folks, she's referring to their state attorney general's office. And some states have independent consumer protection bureaus. And Laura and her colleagues respect the work they do. But it's not the same as having a powerful national agency that enforces federal law.
All these other different places can sort of take up a piece of the enforcement action, but none of them have that same robust power.
Laura and her colleagues are still there. She says their funding comes from private organizations, not the feds.
we're not worried about the lights going out here yet. We have to, you know, maintain some degree of equilibrium when you're speaking to clients that, you know, one of you could have a breakdown at a time, right? And that's never our turn. So, you have to maintain some degree of optimism and positivity, because if you're not optimistic and positive for their outcomes, how can they possibly think that there's hope for the future? And there still is.
Dan Wiseman hosts the podcast An Arm and a Leg, produced in partnership with KFF Health News and member station KUOW. Since Dan's reporting in February, court orders have curbed some of the administration's actions, but things continue to evolve at the CFPB. We also reached out to the agency for comment on where consumers should go to report violations of consumer protection laws, and haven't heard back. The pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet made his public debut at the age of 7, and 56 years later, he made his debut on the fourth floor of NPR's headquarters. Thibaudet is one of the world's most celebrated pianists. He is well known for his interpretations of the French repertoire, but his musical taste cuts across genres and time periods. This frantic piece is by the Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos. And Thibaudet's most recent album takes on a piano concerto by Aram Khachaturian, a prolific Armenian composer from the middle of the 20th century. I sat down with Thibaudet at NPR's Tiny Desk recently after he played a few of his favorite pieces, including one by Ravel called Pavane for a Dead Princess. I wanted to start by talking about the pieces you played today, but something you said about the Ravel piece jumped out to me. You were talking about how he liked his pieces played and the feedback he gave. And I'm wondering how much you think about what the composer saw a piece as. How much is that in your head versus what you want to do with it?
I think it's terribly important. I mean, that's the difference between classical music maybe and jazz. I mean, one of the difference is that we have a score that a composer wrote very specifically with hundreds, millions of details, versus jazz, there's no score. You make it up as it goes, and it's phenomenal, but it's so difficult for us classical musicians because we're trying to just have something in front of you that you follow. It still leaves lots of room for interpretation. That's why you can hear the same piece played by many different instrumentalists, and they all do what is written on the score, but at the same time, it's very different. So there is plenty of room. But so to answer your question about Ravel, I was very lucky because one of my teachers in Paris at the conservatory was Lucette Descaves, and Madame Descaves was a friend and collaborator of Ravel, which is amazing. So I feel I have this direct somehow link through her with Ravel. And she was speaking about him at the present, like if he was going to come up at the door and next time at the next lesson. So I heard a lot about Ravel, a lot of stories about him as a person also, but also specifically about what he wanted and did not want in his music.
And do you stick to that? Do you think about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Oh, no. I always think that Pavane, he had a very particular tempo. He liked it in everything. He wrote everything he wanted. It's not difficult. What I always tell the student, I always said, do what is written in the score. If the composer wrote something, why are you going to change it? You don't know better than he or she does. I mean, they are very specific. And Ravel was extremely specific. It was almost an obsession with him. Every little detail he wanted to write on the score. So you have to do it.
Our producers feel that way about the questions they wrote.
Good, yes, sure.
And with the Brahms piece that followed, how do you approach a piece by someone who's such a big titan of classical music? Do you think about it differently? Do you approach it differently?
I'm actually half German. I know I'm very French, but I'm actually half German. My mother was German, and I do have a half heritage of German, and actually from Hamburg, which is where Brahms was from. And it's very interesting that for some composer, to me, I think when you go to a place, there is a relation between either the nature or the weather, the location, and there is something in Hamburg that really, to me, when you go to Hamburg and when you think of Brahms, there is something about, it's always kind of gray, the winters are very long, you have this low ceiling, it's never really doesn't have that sunshine that you have if you go to Rome, for example. It's a real very special characteristic of Brahms music.
I want to spend the rest of the time talking about somebody whose work you didn't play today, but somebody who's very much in your head right now, and it seems like for a very long period of time. That's Aram Khachaturian, an Armenian composer. You have a new album out featuring his work. I know that you've been fascinated with him for a very long time. Why is that?
Yes, and this piece in particular. I mean, I have to say that everybody knows the saber dance. But that piano concerto, I think, is just one of the most fascinating pieces. It is fascinating because it's just not performed, and I don't understand why everybody plays Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, all when you think of Russian composer, and poor Khachaturian is kind of a little bit forgotten.
They seem to have a moment and then fade.
Yes, exactly. Yes, well, it's complicated, the political situation in Russia in those days, and all it makes it all very complex. We don't really know what was going on and what was going on in the composer's head. But probably 30 years ago or something like that, I was performing every summer at Saratoga at the concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra in the summer series, and Charles Dutoit was the music director. We had played already Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, we just had played, and he always had a Russian night there. And he said, okay, what do we need to play this year? I said, I don't know. And he said, wait, he said, you have to learn something new. He said, how about Khachaturian? I said, what? He said, the Khachaturian concerto. I said, I don't know it. Well, he said, learn it. And I looked at the score. I listened to the fabulous Capelle recording, which is, I think, really the model recording. And I said, that's a great piece. And I started immediately working on it. And I just fell in love with it. And we played it, and I played it quite a few times after that. And I was just so excited about the piece. The energy that is in that piece is incredible. So I tried to play it as much, to program it as much as I could. A lot of people were not interested. And then I started going to my record company, to Decca, and say, okay, let's record the Khachaturian. And they never said no, it's just that it was never a priority. And for some reason, it took virtually 20 years. Wow.
Did you have to just insist on it?
Oh, I have every meeting, I would bring it back again and say, how about Khachaturian? So we finally did it. It was recorded in November 23, live, two live concerts with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and Gustavo Dudamel. And we had a great time. And I'm so happy that finally this piece now I've recorded. And now I play it. I will play it even more now that the recording is out. So I'm going to continue championing the piece.
Well, Johnny Thibaudet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And you can see the full Tiny Desk concert from Jean-Yves Thibaudet at npr.org. Is All Things Considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Special thanks to our longtime fearless weekend leader, Adam Rainey, who is headed off to that sweet Monday through Friday work week. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide, working towards democracy, equity, and justice, at ajws.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hope.